You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Order, order.
Good evening, this is Susan Hume at Westminster, where Gordon Brown says Conservative plans to bar Scots MPs from voting on English issues will be lethal to the Constitution. And he turns to Abraham Lincoln and the Bible.
A house divided cannot stand, and a house divided is brought into desolation.
Also, the head of the National Crime Agency apologises for delays in passing on the names of paedophiles to police forces.
I'm sorry if that has led to harm to children or exposing them to risk, because that's not what we stand for.
A former SAS commander says we cannot defeat Islamic State extremists by military means.
The resources to achieve what you're wanting to do will be limitless, infinite, and more expensive than we can afford.
And we're happy to share our photos on the internet, but what about financial information? But first, it's just over 3 weeks since Scots voted in the independence referendum to stay in the UK. But in a sometimes fractious Commons debate, there was already almost no sign of the solidarity between the pro-union parties that was on show during that campaign. Labour accused the Conservatives of moving the goalposts the morning after the referendum. David Cameron said then he wanted to look at stopping Scottish MPs from voting on English matters in tandem with the further devolution promised to Scots. And the SNP are angry because they think getting agreement on that will hold up devolution. The Leader of the House, William Hague, tried to put that fear to rest.
The three main pro-UK parties have made a vow, indeed, that will be delivered whatever the outcome of the election next year, and it will be delivered whatever our deliberations about England. I know it suits the Scottish National Party to try to pretend they have already been betrayed.
But he said the Scottish proposals were not conditional on sorting out the issue of English votes for English laws. Within moments, the Scottish nationalist Angus McNeill was on his feet.
It was an unconditional vow, which then became conditional as the hangover set in. The Prime Minister, why was the Prime Minister not straight with the Scottish people on the vow before the referendum? And where is the Prime Minister this afternoon?
Labour has said it's going to boycott a body led by William Hague, which will look at England and the future role of Westminster MPs. Labour has 40 Scottish MPs, so barring them from voting on non-Scottish matters might make it difficult for a future Labour government to get its business through Parliament. But William Hague said Labour could have come along and contributed other solutions they liked better.
So I hope nobody from the other side of the House will lecture us about not listening to other ideas when they're not prepared to come and give their ideas at the committee of the Cabinet that's been established.
But Labour spokesman Sadiq Khan said he'd been disappointed that within minutes of the referendum result, the Prime Minister had announced a top-down Westminster elitist solution.
At the moment, a moment when we needed a Prime Minister to show some statesmanship, the day after our country voted to stay together, what we got instead was a short-term partisan fix that had more to do with fighting the United Kingdom Independence Party than what was in the best interest of the United Kingdom.
He called Mr Cameron's ideas a stitch-up.
The British people want to reshape the country and the way it's run, but they won't put up with a top-down imposed statement, because that would be a stitch-up. And that's precisely the kind of response from Westminster that the anti-politics mood is railing against.
But a Conservative, Andrew Percy, leapt to his feet.
What would be the biggest Westminster stitch-up would be to give the English a few scraps off the plate of a few extra powers and a few quid to local government whilst at the same time denying them what they very clearly want in every opinion poll that's conducted in this country, which is they simply expect to be governed by the people who they elect, which is English votes for English laws.
And this was another Conservative, Andrew Bridgen.
The matter of English votes for English laws is a boil that has festered for far too long. And does he appreciate the frustration of my constituents who see Scottish MPs voting on matters that affect North West Leicestershire when, quite rightly, the corresponding legislation has been devolved to Scotland and I have no say over it?
But David Cameron's solution to that problem had made one man furious, and that was the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who's credited by many for turning round the ailing No campaign. He said the vow of more devolution was made on the Tuesday and rewritten by Mr Cameron on the Friday. Devolving tax powers to Scotland and stripping Scottish MPs of voting rights at Westminster was, he said, a lethal cocktail.
You cannot have one United Kingdom if you have two separate classes of members of Parliament. And you cannot have representatives elected by the people who are half in, half out of the lawmaking process. And let us remember the words in the New Testament in Mark, quoted by Lincoln, a house divided cannot stand, and a house divided is brought into desolation. And I believe that that is the truth of what the Conservative Party are now putting.
Angus McNeill from the SNP interrupted.
Is he telling this House that he signed up to a vow without knowing the details of that vow?
Madam Deputy Speaker, I signed up to a vow that I will keep. It was the Prime Minister on the day after the referendum who qualified the promise.
Then up got Ian Stewart, a Conservative with an English constituency who grew up in Scotland and said that he'd been christened by Gordon Brown's father.
There is a similar growth of demand in England for say in her own affairs. And if that is not addressed quickly, we may endanger the very union that he and I both want to preserve.
Gordon Brown said he didn't disagree. The key was for Scots to continue to pay income tax at UK levels and get the representation at Westminster too. The Lib Dem Michael Moore was Scottish Secretary for some of the run-up to the referendum. He argued that the idea of more devolution was hardly anything new.
The vow was important. It underlined what had been happening in Scotland for some time. It wasn't new, it wasn't suddenly coming up with stuff that hadn't been put forward previously.
He said it was now up to the Smith Commission to come up with firm ideas about what that extra devolution should include. But the Scottish Nationalists are deeply suspicious. Pete Wishart said there was a high chance that the ideas in that vow would never get through the House of Commons, and yet Scots had believed in it.
There's some very good evidence to say it might have just swung it, because that was the key thing. The eve of the referendum, it was presented, solemn vow, promise, guarantee of more powers. And already what we're hearing just now is the backtrack in full gear when it comes to these issues.
Now, there was no vote at the end of that debate, but maybe just as well. In the 6 hours, it was clear that MPs are far from any consensus on the right way forward. Now, Islamic State extremists cannot be defeated by military means alone. That was the message to MPs from a range of experts, including a former commanding officer of the SAS. As US jets continued to bomb Islamic State fighters, the Commons Defence Committee began an inquiry into how to halt the advance of the jihadist group. And as Simon Jones reports, the experts all agreed there had to be political change in Iraq.
The radical jihadist group Islamic State, also known as IS or ISIL, has seized large swathes of territory in eastern Syria and across northern and western Iraq. Its brutal tactics, including mass killings and the beheadings of soldiers and western hostages, have sparked outrage across the world and prompted US and British military intervention. But are airstrikes enough to deal with IS? That was the question put to a former commanding officer of the SAS, Lieutenant Colonel Richard Williams.
If you're asking me, is there a way in which we can use, say, an international coalition to defeat ISIL in the absence of a political settlement? But my view at the moment is no.
Colonel Williams said bad strategy is one you cannot afford.
Without a political solution, the resources to achieve what you're wanting to do will be limitless, infinite, and more expensive than we can afford.
Which begged this question from Labour's Derek Twigg.
Doesn't the same rationale apply to just having airstrikes?
Not necessarily, said Richard Williams.
Airstrikes do change the balance of power at the tactical level,
firstly,
for what essentially appears to be militias, Iraqi militias, Peshmerga or elsewhere, fighting ISIL militias in very local areas. These are company actions, they're not very large. But a few bombs, very expensive, delivered the right way, can change the balance of effort in that particular area, help to contain.
But the use of air power alone would not destroy Islamic State. Derek Twigg again.
If we know politically what we want to achieve and what needs to be done to achieve that, but we need to use military force, it has to include both ground troops and air power.
It will, and the entity, if I might say, that should be leading that is an Iraqi entity. And the Iraqi entity, as we've outlined, has been described, needs to be developed, and that can take some time.
That would also require major political changes within Iraq if the country was to avoid breaking up, according to Joost Hilterman from the International Crisis Group.
We face a serious threat from the Islamic State in terms of Iraq's stability and the stability of the region, but it's at heart a political problem. And the only long-term solution that could ever work is a political one.
Professor Toby Dodge of the London School of Economics argued that IS was a phenomenon largely created by what he called the abject failure of the Iraqi political system, set up in 2003 during the occupation of Iraq.
This government, because of its corruption, has squandered its oil wealth, undermined the institutional capacity of the state, and is broadly unpopular across the whole of the country. What we see is successful politicians on a national level playing, like Nouri al-Maliki himself, to the basest possible political campaigns to mobilise around sectarian fear, fear that the Islamic State is going to overrun the whole country. So I think... Although clearly a military aspect to the whole piece is there, I think what would be needed for a sustainable peace is what was failed in to be delivered in 2007 onwards, a representative government that can rebuild the state institutionally.
And that included the Iraqi army, which he said was as feared by many Iraqis as much as IS.
In the collapse of the Iraqi army, you have all the problems of the Iraqi state. Corruption, political interference, sectarian promotion. So to say that you could flood Iraq with foreign soldiers, you could have this time a multilateral, multinational military campaign against them. And these problems won't go away.
But what if the ruling elite in Baghdad were not prepared to be inclusive and bring excluded groups back into government? Joost Hilterman was frank.
Then we're really stuck. If in fact, this government is going to be a government backed by Iran, based on Shiite Islamist parties that do not want to make peace with the Sunni population and its leaders and its representatives, then we have a long-term conflict on our hands.
Which could raise some awkward questions for the senior military figures due to give evidence to the committee next week.
Simon Jones reporting. Still to come, discrimination against peers. They argue that anti-corruption rules put their families at a surprising disadvantage.
My son was unable to access an ATM. My brother was unable to exercise a joint power of attorney.
But first, the ordination of women bishops in the Church of England moved a step closer tonight when members of the House of Lords approved a legal measure that brings in the historic change. In July, the Church's General Synod voted in favour of women bishops by the required two-thirds majority, but the decision still requires the approval of Parliament. Tonight in the Lords, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Most Reverend Justin Welby, said the measure was long overdue.
For many people within the Church of England and others, it has been a process full of frustration when looked at from the outside. And it has been somewhat baffling, particularly in recent years, that something which seems so simple and obvious should have become such a considerable problem.
And he said he hoped women bishops would soon sit on the benches in the House of Lords, so maybe there needed to be a change in the rules.
We have a bunch of young and vigorous bishops who aren't going to retire too soon. And they really don't die very often.
A Conservative, Lady Perry of Southwark, said she'd been a lay member of a group of senior women in the Church of England for several years. It had included archdeacons and deans.
But alas, of course, they had banged their heads against the concrete ceiling which the church, my church, had then imposed upon them. I cannot tell you of the immense pain which many of those women suffered at the feeling that their own church, which they loved and served, still did not recognise the potential that they had.
And a short time later, peers approved the measure on ordaining women bishops without a vote. It now goes to the Commons. Well, in what circumstances is it acceptable to intrude into someone's privacy? Politicians keep coming back to the issue as security threats, technology and human behaviour constantly change. So the Intelligence and Security Committee have been getting a view from the experts, as Christina Cooper now reports.
Sessions of the Intelligence and Security Committee are usually very private affairs, rarely held in public. But now, appropriately for its inquiry into privacy, it's throwing open the doors so the views of a range of experts can be heard, including those of the former Labour Home Secretary, David Blunkett.
I think we should
and we always have in this country, part of our Anglo-Saxon and philosophical view, taking the view that we have to deliberate and we have to be able to demonstrate that there is an absolute overriding imperative before we intrude into people's privacy.
But with the internet, he said, it was now possible to examine private data in a way that just wasn't available in the past.
Envelopes were unsteamed and old-fashioned telecommunications used to have the local village gossip, listening into people's telephone calls from the switchboard. But the world has changed.
And it's changed in other ways too. Younger people, he said, were prepared to give up their privacy in order to show everyone what they were doing with their lives. Every hour, 10 million new photos are put on Facebook, and every day there are around 400 million tweets. Striking figures provided by Charlie Edwards, senior research fellow at the defence and security think tank RUSI. He also said there were 6 million CCTV cameras in the UK, and the data industry was watching everyone too.
I don't think we quite understand, we, the British public, understand how much of our data is collected by private industry, how much of that data is then sold and traded on our behalf, often without our consent.
The former Lib Dem leader, Sir Min Campbell, wanted to explore the new landscape.
A member of my family meets girlfriends by utilising the internet. In order to do so, he reveals quite extraordinary details about his own life, where he lives, his circumstances, things of that kind. And we know too, if we go into one of the supermarket companies, if we buy certain articles, then they build up a profile of us.
The former Labour Communities Secretary Hazel Blears homed in on an issue that's troubling politicians at the moment. Should the security services be able to trawl through vast amounts of electronic data, bulk collection, in the hope of finding something useful?
Do you think there's a connection between the level of threat and how much you're prepared to have this mining of data in order to develop targets? For example, if we were now in a point where there was an imminent danger of attack, do you think that the balance, or if you like, the constraints would change?
A question put to Lady O'Neill, an independent peer and chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. She said it would be difficult to tie these issues down in a way that was compliant with human rights. And she challenged the distinction often made between communications data, the where and when of a call or email, and the actual content.
The technology means that there is now so much communications data that a great deal of content can be reached by a matter of inference. And as the contemporary information society is not a surveillance but an inferential society, I think we have to realise inferences will be made from data.
Lady O'Neill, who's a philosopher, also pointed out that ideas about privacy varied across Europe.
In, I think, a couple of the Scandinavian states, everyone's income tax return is online for the public to look at. It strikes me that that must be a very, very salutary, though not perhaps a very popular measure.
And a measure unlikely to take root in the UK, where tax is considered to be an exceptionally private issue.
Christina Cooper reporting. The head of the National Crime Agency has apologised to MPs for the failure to react more quickly to the existence of a file containing the names of men who'd paid to view child abuse images online. Keith Bristow was explaining to the Home Affairs Committee why police forces weren't given the list of names until 16 months after the list had been produced by officials in Canada. The committee's chairman is the Labour MP Keith Vaz.
I feel that this has damaged your reputation considerably. From your very important start and your commitments made to this committee that this was going to be a different organisation to SOCA and all those other organisations, where you have information with 2,400 odd names sitting in somewhere in your organisation, you don't know it's there till a different police force rings you up and said, well, you've had it for a year and a half.
Keith Bristow said as soon as the National Crime Agency became aware of the significance of the file, it was distributed to police forces around the country.
I wish we had known sooner. I wish it hadn't have been retained as long as it had without being allocated out to police forces. but we took immediate action as soon as we became aware.
So you'd like to apologise to the victims for having not acted in a appropriate way?
The difficulty I've got is IPCC are now investigating this, but it does seem to me that
apologising?
No, I'm going to get there, Chairman. Sitting on data for the period of time between July 2012 and November 2013 that could have led to children being protected or safeguarded seems to me, whether it's systemic or it's down to individuals, and there are certainly some systemic issues that we need to work through, that is not in the spirit of what we stand for, and I'm sorry if that has led to harm to children or exposing them to risk, because that's not what we stand for.
Keith Bristow. Now, the effect of the Coalition's housing benefit changes on unpaid carers has been spelled out by a Labour MP. Barbara Keeley said Labour plan to abolish what they call the bedroom tax if elected to government next year. Her bill would, meanwhile, bring in an exemption if a member of a household with a spare room was entitled to a carer's allowance and if a person needed overnight care.
Carers UK tell us that 2.3 million people have given up work to care. For me, it's an insult to carers who have had to make the difficult decision to give up work so that they can care for a family member to be penalised even further for that decision.
She said her bill introduced simple measures that would improve the financial situation of carers and their families. There were cries of shame from Labour MPs when the Conservative, David Nuttall, rose to speak against the bill. He said the issue wasn't whether carers provided valuable support, but whether it was fair that taxpayers paid for rooms which were often empty and unused.
The motion before the House today is a good reminder to the public that the election of another Labour government would signal a return to the something-for-nothing culture which this government has put an end to.
MPs voted by a majority of 196 to give initial approval to Barbara Keeley's bill, but with no government support, it will not become law. Claims of marital strife in the Coalition surfaced once again during questions to the Deputy Prime Minister when a Tory backbencher asked Nick Clegg to consider divorce. But the Lib Dem leader stayed loyal, backing the government's health service reforms, which have been the subject of hostile briefings to the press. Joanna Shin reports.
How early in his regular question session could Nick Clegg be asked if it was time to break up the Coalition? MPs have to stick to the questions on the order paper, so it was a test of ingenuity to make the point but still appear to be relevant. Question two was on social mobility. As good a moment as any, the Conservative Sir Edward Lee leaped in.
Social mobility is often impeded in unhappy relationships. This is typified when one of the partners starts tearing a strip in public of his partner's, often motivated by declining self-worth and familial support. Is not divorce a better option?
Was Sir Edward hankering after another man, Mr Clegg wondered?
I think the problem in a relationship is when one party feels bitter from the first day that they are caught in a relationship. Where they feel they shouldn't have entered into it in the first place. I know he wants to call time on this particular political relationship and instead enter into a sort of lock-in with Nigel Farage, but I'm not sure if that relationship would be any happier.
The search for any telltale fraying at the edges of the Coalition continued. Monday's Times reported unhappiness in senior government ranks with the Coalition's reorganisation of the NHS. Labour's deputy leader, Harriet Harman, wondered if Nick Clegg was one of the unhappy figures.
Will he now admit that it was wrong for his party to vote for the top-down NHS reorganisation? Does he now regret that?
Nick Clegg raised the record of the previous Labour government.
I'm always struck how brave she is to be quite as pious about the NHS as she appears. Her government was the government of mid-staffs and Morecambe Bay. It was her government that introduced six times as many increase in number of managers as nurses.
Back to the general election and a question with a sting in the tail from the Conservative Philip Hollobone.
Does the Deputy Prime Minister support televised election debates for the three main political parties? And does he also feel that he should be invited?
Nick Clegg was quick to point out how things stand at the moment.
Whilst I can understand the concerns of parties with only one MP in this House, as a leader of a party with 55 MPs in the House, I don't want any of the larger parties to use the angst amongst the very, very small parties with only one MP in this House to serve as an alibi for foot-dragging. Let's get on with it and have these debates.
No MP can be entirely sure how they will fare following a general election, but Nick Clegg has that fact pointed out to him more than most.
Joanna Shin reporting. Rules designed to root out corruption and money laundering are hindering the children of members of the House of Lords when they try to open bank accounts. That was the claim of several peers when debate at question time turned to PEPs, or politically exposed persons, a group deemed to be high risk by international banks. A Labour peer, Lord Harris, highlighted the problem to a Treasury minister.
Perhaps he could explain why my daughter, who was then aged 12, was required to appear with her driving licence and a utility bill in her name to explain why she should be allowed to have a savings account with no more than 40 quid in it.
The idea behind banks scrutinising politically exposed persons is to ensure they're not unwittingly helping corrupt politicians to squirrel away public money, often in foreign bank accounts. But peers are surprised at the way the rules are applied. The Lib Dem, Lord Clement Jones, described the effect on his family.
My son was unable to access an ATM. My brother was unable to exercise a joint power of attorney. My Lord, sir, what steps is the Treasury taking to show to members of Parliament of both houses that in future they will be treated exactly the same as a deposed dictator or a political pariah?
And this was the independent peer, Lord Wright.
My two sons, coincidentally, tried to open bank accounts in Singapore and in New York, and in both cases were asked who their father was, and on discovering that I was a member of this house, were both refused accounts.
The Treasury Minister, Lord Dayton, said he'd take those complaints up with the banks.
I mean, of course, what we're trying to accomplish here is a balance, you know, a balance which makes life impossible for corrupt politicians, terrorists and criminals to go about their business, but which leaves the rest of us unimpeded to go about our lives in a normal way.
Lord Dayton there. Well, last week's by-elections are now out of the way, but the day in the Commons began with the moving of a writ for the next one. The job was done by the Conservative Chief Whip, Michael Gove.
I beg to move that Mr Speaker do issue his warrant to the Clerk of the Crown to make out a new writ for the electing of a member to serve in this present Parliament for the county constituency of Rochester and Strood.
The election in the Kent constituency has been triggered by the resignation of Mark Reckless as a Conservative MP. He's defected to UKIP and will fight the election for his new party. It'll be held on Thursday, the 20th of November. And before we go, our main news again. Gordon Brown has warned Conservatives that plans to bar Scottish MPs from voting at Westminster will be lethal to the Constitution. And the head of the National Crime Agency has apologised for delays in passing the names of paedophiles on to police forces. I'm Susan Hume, the editor was Keith McDougall, and that was Today in Parliament.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.